Welcome to the Milt Rosenberg podcast. And yes, of course, this is Milt Rosenberg, who manages this operation by bringing in brilliant people that he's known for some time or that he's met only recently and who've only recently done books. My guest now is an old friend. Daniel Garrison is professor of classics at Northwestern University, fairly recently emeritized, and has a great book that's shortly going to appear, which we are not going to discuss tonight at all. But let's say a word about it before we turn to the history of the decline of Rome and whether we can learn anything about the management of modern nations and modern societies by looking at that great ancient story. But before we get into any of that, you've in recent years focused on somebody else who wrote in Latin much later, Vesalius.
Yes, Andreas Vesalius of Brussels, who was 28 when he published probably the most important medical book in the history of the modern world, On the Fabric of the Human Body.
And in Latin, that is.
It was in Latin, De Humani Corporis Fabrica,
yeah.
Written in the very difficult Latin that was espoused by the humanists, and chief among them Erasmus of Rotterdam. Who wrote a handbook on what he called the copious style, the abundant style, which was the very opposite of what you and I were taught to write, which is you should write long, complex, periodic sentences, you should use a huge vocabulary, and your writing thereby becomes impressive. It is impressive, but very, very difficult to read.
You're talking about that special language, academic English.
Well,
academic written English.
Academic written English, but far worse than that was academic written German until about the halfway point in the 20th century when they decided to throw in the towel on this impossible German and write in a brief, clear, and succinct language.
Well, not necessarily so brief or succinct. I'm always amused when I get translated into German, which has happened to me a few times. I did one major thing, which was published as a chapter in a book. Then somebody asked permission to translate it and to publish it in some German book, which they did. And it came out almost at least a third to almost a half longer than the original. In German, it's Attitudenveränderungen Außenpolitik in der Ära des Kalten Krieges, Attitude Change and Foreign Policy in the Era of the Cold War. And it just writes itself much, much longer than if you're in English. But now, let's go to Latin, and let's go to Rome. And let me raise the basic question, and I'll bring in that old saw by George Santayana. Was he right when he says those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it? I find my undergraduates knew very little of classic history or history of classical antiquity, unless they took special courses in it. But even so, they couldn't really manage history because they were not fully or properly educated in historical analysis and in historical fact. They don't even know the history of the United States particularly well, let alone the history of the rise of the Roman Republic, its transformation into the Imperium, and its ultimate decline, the Western form of the Roman Republic, in the year 476 A.D., as someone has given as the terminus, because that's the date of the death, I guess, of the last emperor.
Yes, the last emperor, Augustulus, came in a little before that, 460 A.D. Most of the Roman emperors had shorter periods of rule than a one-term American president.
Oh, yes.
So the instability was built into the empire.
That year, A.D., is it 69? The year of the four emperors?
Year of the four emperors, yes.
Yeah.
It was fundamentally unstable because it fundamentally lacked the checks and balances that existed under the Roman Republic.
Well, that's, of course, then the basic task that I'm setting for you, and you've been kind enough to accept that challenge. Is it true that if we can learn something, following what Santayana's injunction, we can learn something valuable for modern statecraft and modern cultural management or whatever, if we examine closely the rise and the fall of the great Roman Republic?
Yes, the Roman Republic.
The Roman civilization.
The
Republic
Roman,
and
Roman
Imperium.
Civilization, you know. The Nazis got the word for the Thousand-Year Reich,
right,
because they sort of modeled it on the tradition of the Roman Empire and Roman Republic lasting 1,000 years. So we Americans who pride ourselves on our constitutional system have a long way to go in terms of years.
Well, if you want a date from 1776, we're there.
We're fairly new on the scheme of things, but American politics was designed by neoclassical scholars like Thomas Jefferson, who understood these old Greek political science, the idea of checks and balances, the idea of the balance of powers. So we got off to a privileged start because we were reading the lessons of history.
And one great English writer had drawn the lessons of history concerning the decline and fall of Rome at just about that time. 1776, is that when Gibbon publishes his first volume or his last volume?
You know, I don't know exactly how to answer that question.
But it's around then.
It's around that time that he's looking back on the decline and fall, especially.
Of the Roman Empire.
Which means the imperial period, yes.
Yeah, though, of course, for him, the Roman Empire runs 1,000 years beyond that year of 476 because Byzantium in the east is another part of the Roman Empire, and it persists until the Ottoman Turks take it over.
Yes, he really doesn't have a fall in quite the same sense until the Ottoman Turks came along. And by that time, the Eastern Empire had its own corruptions.
To be sure. But let's focus on the Western Empire and its rise, its flourishing, and its decline. And the question I raise particularly is, what were the causes of the decline? When I mentioned Gibbon's book, it's a wonderful set of volumes, 5 volumes ordinarily, and rich with all sorts of detail. But basically, he comes out with his cautionary conclusion, which is Christianity killed the Roman Empire.
Yes, and we recently did, it wasn't so recently. Some years ago, we had a program on the reasons for the decline and fall, and we had an expert, constitutional expert in from the University of Chicago who lugged in a book that gave something like 65 reasons that have been proposed, major reasons that have been proposed over the years for the decline and fall. So it's a great mystery. One of the answers that deserves a lot of attention still, I think, is lead poisoning. There was so much lead in the air from the silver that was being mined and refined in Spain. The prevailing winds blew from Spain over the Italian peninsula and brought high levels of atmospheric lead. Plus, wine was preserved and manufactured with lead pipes, and the acid in the wine leached the lead out of the pipes. And so this is one of many reasons that have been put forward.
Let me give you some 8 reasons why Rome fell. I'm drawing from something on the internet that is passably well written by Evan Andrews. I don't know the name, but he's probably an historian or a graduate student in history. And he raises the question, what are the reasons that have been most frequently given by historians? And here's the list from 1 to 8. 1, invasions by barbarian tribes. 2, economic troubles and over-reliance on slave labor. 3, the rise of the Eastern Empire. 4, overexpansion and military overspending. 5, government corruption and political instability. 6, the arrival of the Huns and the migration of the barbarian tribes, that is from east to west, of the barbarian Germanic tribes, he means. 7, Christianity and the loss of traditional values. And 8, weakening of the Roman legions. Do any of those grab you particularly?
I think they're all good reasons, and they all deserve sufficient scrutiny. One of the paradoxes of the German migrations is the German invasions of Roman space were not necessarily hostile invasions. They were invasions of people who wanted to get in and enjoy the economic stability and prosperity and the safety of Roman law.
And the great Roman legions, the great military force of Rome, by the 4th century, had in it many men of Germanic background.
Yes, and as we look through the long list of people who had been emperors of Rome in the empire, the secret got out fairly early that you didn't have to be born in Rome or of a Roman family to become emperor. And so there was a good deal of internal invasion by military men who were of German background, who had served on the frontier, and had correspondingly a lot of legions under their control.
Is there an identifiable German emperor of Rome itself?
Well,
there are Spaniards and so on. Septimus Severus was, I believe,
yes.
Spanish in origin.
Yes. I don't know if it was in the Nervan Antonian dynasty. You get, for example, Commodus, I think was a German general who had taken a Roman name. A good deal of the damage inflicted on the Roman Empire was inflicted by friendly fire, so to speak.
Yeah. Do all great bureaucratized governmental systems sooner or later, come a cropper, do they sooner or later kind of defeat themselves by their complexity and by the overindulgence in the rewards that are available to the elite?
I think that's probably more than a little true. When a bureaucracy displaces the power of the native people, the power of the ordinary people, the mos maiorum, as the Romans themselves call it, which was the mores of ancestors. When that gets displaced by a bureaucratic class, when the bureaucratic class begins to imitate and replicate itself, then the possession of power becomes separated from the source of power, which is the people at the bottom who are creating the wealth.
Let's look at some details of Roman history as we examine these various causes. What comes to your mind illustrative of that generalization?
Well, illustrative of the generalization, we talked about the legions as being... Mm-hmm. The legions took on a life of their own. They created the power where they were, and they really dictated the terms under which the territory that they commanded would be ruled. An old Roman, you know, I'll give you another Latin phrase, the old Roman idea, what is it, the safety of the people, let the safety of the people be the supreme power. And when that passes, let the safety of the bureaucracy become the supreme power, then the vitality of the nation state or the group of people so governed becomes weaker.
I can't resist a modern free association. Thinking of our government and our society, American society, at this very moment, and I think of the IRS problem or the IRS scandal, maybe. Mm-hmm. We just discussed that earlier today as we recorded another program. Is that the arrogance of bureaucracy? Is that just the inefficiency of bureaucracy? Because bureaucracy tends to get rigid and very often misses the mark with regard to doing its work properly.
Yeah, arrogance and inefficiency really are cut out of the same piece of bread. If you believe that you have that you have some implicit power to regulate beyond what the rules allow, then you begin doing things or trying to do things or thinking of doing things that undermine the fundamental valor of and the legitimacy of a government. It doesn't necessarily happen by a violent overthrow. It can happen by erosion.
Another modern correlate or parallel to what seems to be moving in the story of Rome is demographic change. Some have argued demography is destiny. Sooner or later, you could account for almost everything in history by the movement of peoples and by the rise and fall, whether through invasion or through immigration policy or what have you, of one elite replaced by another, of one people in some part replaced by another. American demography is changing right now. There was a recent projection worked up by professional demographers that by, I forget what year it is is it 2050 or 2040, but you will no longer have a Caucasian majority in the total population of the United States.
Yes, that's a, it's a great irony, because one of those non-Caucasian groups were people whose ancestors came over here as slaves. So black Americans, African Americans are one of those growing demographic groups. They're growing not just in numbers, but they're growing in participation and in placement within the leadership of the
government. And the great movement from the South to the North.
And then the great movement, the migration of African Americans from the South, where they had been held as slaves, into northern places like Detroit, where they got into manufacturing.
But I'm thinking of the more recent South to North migration, namely of
the Latinos.
The Latinos.
Yes.
Who have become a major, major component of the American polity. What happened along those lines, similar to these processes, in Rome?
Well, in Rome, you have two, I won't say immigrant groups, but you have two groups pressing from sort of opposite directions. You have the North Africans, who eventually became Muslim, but you have people from North Africa wanting to be part of the empire because they wanted to share in the benefits of Roman law and Roman commerce. So they come in, and we have to remember that some of the great leaders of early Christianity, such as St. Augustine, Augustine was a North African, so was Tertullian. So we have people coming in from the South, in the case of Rome, from North Africa. And then you have the groups that you described recently as being the Germanic. Dare we call them the Germanic hordes? There were many of them.
Well, the Goths, the Vandals,
yes,
et cetera.
The Alans and so on. All of these people were wanting to participate in the Roman in the Rome Pax Romana, the Roman peace. And in order to do that, they wanted to move into Roman territory. There was what the Germans would call Lebensraum in the southern part of Europe. You had better weather in the southern part of Europe. And so naturally, they came in looking for land to settle.
And but as they come in and as they Romanize themselves, why then don't they persist in maintaining the Roman culture and the Roman civilization and, for that matter, even Roman power?
Well, in a way, they're diluting it, not necessarily in a bad way, but they're combining Roman institutions with their own institutions. Mm-hmm. For example, in I think this goes back to Tacitus in describing the Germans, women have more power in the Germanic world. And so that is a cultural change that comes in. Another group to bear in mind, and they go back quite a way further, is Spain. The Romans wanted Spain because of its silver and gold and minerals, lead. They wanted that territory, but the Spaniards were also great fans of the Romans, and some of the greatest writers of the early empire were, in fact, native Spaniards.
Such as?
Well, I'm thinking of Seneca. The two Senecas, the older and younger Seneca, were both Spaniards. They had a nephew who also moved to Rome. A great paradox is that no Roman author ever came from Rome. They all came from other places.
Well, many of them were Greeks by origin.
And, well, Galen, for example. Yeah. Galen was
And
was
the historians, a Polybius.
Yes.
Who's of great fascination.
Yes, Livy, who came from Padova. They were all. Why didn't Rome have any writers of its own? This is a great paradox.
Well, surely they had some. Juvenal is a native Rome, is a native Italian at least. Is
he's
he? Not?
He's a native Italian, but I think he has very close
Rome,
Spanish
right?
ties.
Oh, does he really?
Yeah.
Because I think you once introduced me, either you or one of your colleagues, to a wonderful Juvenal satire about the Greeks, about all the Greeks who are filling Rome and are corrupting Rome.
Yes.
And are,
Juvenal is very funny because he takes on these various personae of angry old men.
exactly,
who've had it up to here and aren't going to stand it anymore. And one of them is the virulent anti-Greek. It's very interesting, though. The Greeks, Horace himself says that the Greeks, when captured, took the barbarian Romans captive. The Greeks were captivated by Greek culture and by Greek ideas. Their constitutional ideas were essentially Greek.
As we look at the quick survey of the many reasons historians have given for the fall, the ultimate decline of Rome, one that really stands out, and I just quote it again, is overexpansion and military overspending. Isn't that really, in some ways, at least in older history, if not in contemporary history, isn't that really a universal pattern? You extend too far, you spend too much, you are too ambitious, and ultimately you can't manage the extended political entity that you have created. It taxes and overburdens the government, and in fact, in 100 different ways, it corrupts the maintenance of a particular civilization with its own inner authenticity.
Well,
I said you don't find modern examples, but now that I think of it, the expansion of Germany under the Nazis,
yes,
could be a very good example.
Yes. The senators were, in fact, the first people who wanted to expand. The Senate saw the Eastern world, the world of Greece, as being full of statues they wanted to have in their gardens. The Senate saw the world as a place that they could pillage with impunity. And so they started this movement. The movement outlasted them. The Senate collapsed in a state of civil war before Julius Caesar imposed his own will upon them. And so the Senate destroyed itself by its own greed and by its own internal competition. It was a great deal of fratricide, of mutual assassination, of people rewarding themselves with the estates of rivals whom they denounced and had executed. So the old idea of senatorial administration fell apart. At the same time, if you look at a map of the Mediterranean basin and see how far it extended, even by Augustus, who was not the last person to expand the Roman Empire, without communications, in spite of their great Roman road system, you couldn't get information from one place to the next very quickly. You certainly couldn't move troops around. I mean, right now President Obama's talking about sending 100 troops into Baghdad, and he can do that within a few hours. You couldn't do anything within a few hours in this pre-industrial world. It was too big.
Though, in fact, by modern standards, it isn't all that vast geographically, is it?
Not by modern standards, and that's because of high-speed travel and high-speed communication.
Yeah.
So you can today at least know what's going on. How could a Roman know what's going on in Britain? It took years before Hadrian knew he was going to have to build a wall along the Scottish border to prevent further incursions into Roman Britain.
One great dimension of historical analysis, or even of historical argument, is the difference between a great man theory of history, the Carlylean approach, mm-hmm, and a social forces theory of history, or method of historical analysis. Focus on the great men for a moment. Are there figures in Roman history who stand out for the influence they had and stand out for the thought that if they had died in infancy, the history of Rome might have been quite different?
Well, certainly if you look at the very early stage of Roman history, the period of the Seven Kings, which mm-hmm. is partly mythologized, the last of the Etruscan rulers, Tarquinius the Proud, Tarquinius Superbus, was removed from office by the first Brutus.
Mm-hmm.
An ironic name, because Brutus was among the assassins of Julius Caesar in 44 BC. So I think that first Brutus is an example of the kind of person you mentioned.
And you can also play the counterfactual game. And since you mentioned Brutus and Caesar, the later Brutus, who was one of the main fomenters of the plot and who did also stab, et tu, Brute, and even you did it, Brutus, therefore I will die, says Caesar, at least as represented by Shakespeare. Do the counterfactual. Somehow the plot was discovered and exposed, and maybe by Cicero, and was squelched, so that Julius Caesar goes on for a considerably longer life. What would have happened in the history of Rome?
Well, it's easy to imagine that Julius Caesar, being one of the most intelligent people in the ancient world, in my view, that Julius Caesar might have done what his adoptive grandnephew, Augustus Caesar, eventually did, which is to, for better or worse, and immediately it was certainly very much for the better, to bureaucratize the administration of Rome.
And to undo the Republican establishment.
And to undo the Republican establishment, to maintain the appearance of a Senate, as Augustus would do.
Yes, he did.
He does a great deal to bolster the perceived power of the Senate, but at the same time, he puts in place an administration which is not submissive.
We called him the first emperor, but he insisted that he was merely a kind of a lifelong appointee.
Yeah.
And he says his slogan is that he was primus inter pares, I think. Is that
he
right?
He was primus inter pares. He also took the
which means I'm the first among equals.
First among equals, yes, like Agamemnon in the Greek army of the Iliad. Yes, and he also called himself princeps. And that name stuck. We call it the Roman principate. The princeps is the first man. He's the head person. It's a beguilingly vague word, but it's one that Augustus liked, and I think Julius Caesar would have made good use of it as well had he lived.
Isn't it interesting to note, projecting forward in history, that the very term for king or for emperor is essentially based on, as used in some of the countries and in some of the major languages,
yes,
is essentially Caesar.
Yes.
Kaiser,
uh-huh,
in the Germanic world.
Yes.
And I gather Tsar in the...
Tsar is
the Russian version
derivative.
Of
yes, uh-huh.
So Caesar becomes king or becomes emperor.
Yeah, he becomes... But at the same time, the Romans took the word rex as being politically loaded, so they never used the basic Latin word for king, except for those legendary seven first kings of Rome.
Shall we examine Gibbon's complaint and take it seriously, or rather his diagnosis of the ideology of the fall of Rome, at least the fall of the Western Empire, namely Christianity?
Well, Christianity was at first perhaps rightly seen by the pagan establishment as being a challenge to their power. The idea was that the early Christians refused to perform in a supplicant manner towards the divinity of the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And so they refused to make these gestures because they recognized only Christ as their head man. And because of that, there were famous events in which Christians were fed to the lions in the Colosseum and similar things, similar executions of Christians were made, summary executions which were supposed to terrorize, but in fact only created a cadre of people who were admired by the Christians as putting their religion and putting their God ahead of the God of Caesar. And so Christ says in one of his most quoted sayings, render unto Caesar those things which are Caesar's, and unto God those things which are God's. The Romans didn't like that. The pagan emperors didn't like that. They felt threatened by it.
You are a classicist and a classics historian, but you also live in a modern world, and you know the materials of modern history, including the politics of international relations to the very present moment, which is June of the year 2014. Do you find your mind turning to Rome, particularly as you look at modern nations and their interaction, and for that matter, the competition between them?
Well, you do. You can't help thinking of certain figures like Vladimir Putin, who imagines a Soviet empire, post-Soviet Russian empire, in which he can take advantage of opportunities to annex territory. The best example now being the Crimea and sections neighboring the Crimea.
And his ambitions for, to lop off some portion of Ukraine, or so we are told.
So it appears. And people inside the Ukraine wanting to be Russian rather than Ukrainian. Yeah. So that's being taken advantage of.
Well, that's rather like the Germans coming down and becoming citizens or near citizens of Rome. A lot of those Russian-speaking people in Ukraine, and for that matter in the Baltic countries, were in fact shipped in during even Stalin's regime, and certainly in the post-Stalin, post-war period, as a kind of way of reorganizing the great polity of the total USSR.
Yes, that is perhaps Putin is a person who, by not knowing history, is condemned to repeat it.
Oh, yes.
Only time will tell. Uh-huh. But that's the example that I think most readily comes to mind in this June 2014, that Putin is playing a game that he can't win, that annexation of territory doesn't work in the 21st century on any scale. And when it does work at all, it works at a cost which is excessive.
Do we see in more modern history, more modern than the history of Rome, essentially illustrations of the same point? Is the decline of the British Empire possibly to be viewed in those terms?
Well, certainly the decline of the British Empire, we associate that most clearly, I guess, with the rise of India as a modern state, but also with the Japanese invasions in Asia. Many of the people, such as, for example, the Burmese, many of the people the Japanese invaded regarded the Japanese at first as being liberators from the oppressive rule of England.
Japanese, during the years of the war, trumpeted that they were building an East Asia co-prosperity sphere.
Yes, it was wonderful.
Term.
Yeah, the Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, and that immediately caught the sense of humor of everybody in the West thinking about this co-prosperity. The Japanese didn't manage it very well, and it crumbled in their hands as the conquered nations realized that the new conqueror was worse than the British Empire. Churchill had to be somewhat set aside among the great leaders of the West because so much of his evident and obvious ambition was to restore the old British Empire on which the sun never set. The old maps of the British Empire always marked British territory in red, which is a great irony to me. But that red portion of the globe shrunk faster and faster as the Second World War went on, and it became clear that nobody wanted to help Winston Churchill recover the old British Empire.
Who are the great Roman historians? Which ones do you personally find most essentially valid and most essentially insightful?
Well, you have to, I think, mention Livy, although much of Livy has been lost.
Yeah.
Ab urbe condita, which means from the city's beginning, from the building of the city, up until his own time. It was during...
He's a historian of the Republic, essentially.
He's a historian of the Republic. And it's really during this period, the end of the Republic and the beginning of the Empire, it was actually written, I think, under the Augustan Principate. It was about this time that the Romans began to feel a need for history. And they had only scraps to work from. They had annals, which are annual reports of what had happened in the Roman state. But it was very fragmented. And then Livy himself, his own work, Ab urbe condita, and I think, 30 or 35 books, it was shredded by neglect. And so we don't have enough of Livy to know what the people in the Augustan world imagined their past to be. another and later writer, Tacitus, who wrote about the early empire, but he wrote from a very different point of view. He was now writing under the later Julio-Claudian emperors and realized that they were either incompetent or scoundrels or lunatics or all of the above.
Suetonius is a lesser historian, is he? Because he's essentially a great gossip.
He records a great deal of gossip. He is interested in the early emperors of Rome, and he too is a sort of mixed in his sympathies towards this great Roman machine.
Yeah.
Because he realizes how much corruption exists under the surface.
Which of the ones we've mentioned, and there are yet many other historians one could quickly list, which of them might make the most sense of or most readily recognize what the modern world has become and what's happening in the modern world?
Well, I suppose Tacitus might be the one.
So if Tacitus were sitting with us at this very table, what sort of thing would he begin to ruminate about?
I think he would begin to ruminate at the power of corrupt influences in American life, in the life anywhere, special influences which have perhaps no contribution to make in the life and safety of the Republic. Again, think of that Latin saying, "Salus publica suprema lex esso," let the safety of the people be the supreme law. And if you look at the food we eat, if we go down in the street and have lunch, or if we go into a grocery store and buy food, we are likely to find that our food has been overprocessed. It's often contaminated, and it's not necessarily the best diet. So that's just an example.
The last thing that comes to my mind, necessarily because we're almost out of time, I think I made mention earlier in our conversation of Polybius. Polybius is one of the earliest of the cyclic historians, isn't he? Mm-hmm. And he sees the inevitability of the rise and then the fall of all civilizations as they come along, each one replacing a prior civilization.
Yes, and he was sort of a political scientist, too. Political science wasn't an academic field in those days, but the Greeks had made it a study. What are the lasting and persistent forces in any polity?
Well, what would Polybius have to say about the contemporary world, not merely the United States, but in general, as he looked at the various competing powers? China is rising as a new great power, which will in some sense inevitably challenge us. The other great one is the Islamic world generally.
Yes.
I'm thinking of the work of that great Harvard modern political scientist who saw the clash of civilizations, Sam Huntington. And he said two great conflicts to come are between the West and China and between the West and Islam.
And Islam. I think he would probably have looked at what he perceived as stabilizers. Uh-huh. What stabilizers are there? And I think Polybius would say, based on his study of Greek political science, would say that although Islam and the Chinese Empire represent threats to the safety of to their own safety and to their own stability, that they are not the long-term threats. As we listen to the news today, we listen to a controversy that's going on. Should we try to save Baghdad?
Yes.
And there is a very strong thesis being made that it's doing us no good to save Baghdad because it is fundamentally unstable. And so that's where political science comes into play. What are the forces, what are the institutions and the powers that make a polity stable on the long run and therefore worth saving?
Which was in a way the focus, but also touched with strong pessimism or strong sense of the tragic, the focus of the work of Thucydides, going way back to the Peloponnesian War. He saw states inevitably rising to challenge other neighboring states by trying to steal what the other guys possess. And then the great motivation towards war is a compensatory concern with anticipating the aggressions of the end of the potential antagonist, who is more or less a neighbor, and preempting him.
Yes.
And then also, topping all of that, those two of the goads to war, the third great goad, according to Thucydides, is somehow a need for honor.
Yes, he was. This goes back as far as Homer, that Greek mm-hmm. polity was in the first place a timocracy. We took over that timocracy is the rule of prestige and influence. I suppose the other great timocratic societies in America today are university faculties.
Oh my!
Where you're not paid in money, you're paid in teammate, you're paid in honor and respect, and if you are more often footnoted than your rival, then you can claim victory over them. That's something that the Greeks were very much influenced by this mm-hmm. idea of prestige.
We are just about at the end of the available time. All in all, as an historian based in the classical world but very fully aware of the modern world, are you optimistic at all? Does the tragic sense dominate if one really looks closely at the history of the rise and fall of Rome or of Greece or of any of the cultures that succeeded beyond that?
I think we can be optimistic in some senses. I think we can be optimistic in that our basic institutions, which are neoclassical institutions, America's a neoclassical republic, our institutions are more likely to survive than rival institutions that do not have these, for example, checks and balances. We do not, you know, we have a Supreme Court. We have division of power. We have checks upon the power. As long as we're able to keep this, absolute power corrupts absolutely. As long as we can keep that, Lord Acton, wasn't it, who said this, power corrupts.
He said power tends to corrupt.
Power tends to corrupt.
And absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yes, that's right. It's
an interesting distinction.
It's an interesting distinction, but it's one that we must never forget.
Yeah.
Is that the more power you have, the more likely you are to misuse it in some way or another. It may be a violation of sensibilities, but it may just as likely be a violation of people's guaranteed rights and powers.
Daniel Garrison, as ever, I'm deeply impressed by your erudition and by its practicality and its tightness of focus as you shift from one decade, rather from one civilization to another. And so I thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.